This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
This evening we're going to start off looking at a few important medrashim on the end of the sixth day, and then we're going to start dealing with Shabbos. And in dealing with Shabbos, I'm going to have to do it by means of, again, focusing on a number of different ideas, and it's probably only next week that we'll pull it together in a clear understanding of what Shabbos is. Is it disturbing? So we have to choose between listening and being comfortable. Sorry? You can't hear because of that one? You can hear. At the back, can you hear all right? Laurie, can you hear? In fact, I think I'm going to move this a bit further forward also. It will probably help a little bit. Don't you think so? The opening medrash on the sixth day, and it all revolves around the last verse of the sixth day, which is the last verse of the first chapter, verse 31, Lamed Aleph. Vayara Elokim es kol asher oso, and Hashem saw all that he had done, v'hinei tov mo'ed, and it was very good. So there are two differences between this statement and the similar statements of previous days. Firstly, it's not Vayara Elokim es asher oso, Hashem looked at what he had done, but Hashem looked at all that he had done. It's kol asher oso, v'hinei tov ma'od, and it was exceptionally good. Not just good, it was exceptionally good. So there's an element of extreme satisfaction at the end of the sixth day. One of the important medrashim, which doesn't affect us directly but impacts on the way we approach things from here, is one that I spoke on around Rosh Hashanah time, and that is the medrash's use of a verse in Mishlei, Kavod Elokim Haster Dovor Uchvod Malochim Chakur Dovor. The honor of Hashem rests in hiding things, and the honor of kings rests in revealing things. Rabbi Levi b'shem Rabbi Chama bar Chanina Omar, mitchilas ha-sefer va'ad kan, from the beginning of the Torah until this point where we are right now, that's all classified as kavod elokim hu haster dover. The honor of God revolves around hiding things. Mikan ve'elech kavod malochim chakur dover. From here onwards, we're dealing with the honor of kings in analyzing and revealing things and analyzing. And we pointed out that in implied here is a type of a pulse that has to exist throughout existence. It exists in every area of life, and that is the relationship between discovery and hiding, the relationship between mystery and revelation. Between mystery and discovery, we called it, and I devoted a few months of Shabbos Shirim to it at the time as well, that there can only be discovery if there is mystery. Mystery is only valuable if it leads to discovery. And the pulse that we're talking about is one it's the mystery and the discovery pulse. And that impacts on a lot of areas. Firstly, it's in our relationship with God, as the Medrash says over here. God is so infinite that he creates things in a way that is mysterious, leaving us to discover them. He allows us the process of discovery. Not only does he allow us the process of discovery, but he commands us to discover. That's our most important role, is to discover God, because to know God, that we knew him before we were born, when we were just spirits up there, and we weren't put onto this world. If our purpose was knowledge of God, then we shouldn't have been born in the first place, because we knew him better when we were up there, and we'll know him better when we get back there. So this is not a place for knowing God. What is this world? This is a place for discovering God. So the essence of this world, the essence of life here, is discovery. And that's a drive, it's a natural drive that the human being has. One sees that expressed in all sorts of other areas as well, in the areas of science, in the areas of every sphere of knowledge. There is an innate urge in the human being to discover, to unravel God's secrets. The purpose, of course, is that it should lead to a knowledge of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that as you discover, what you should be discovering is God. It doesn't always work like that. Sometimes people go through a process of discovery. They can be great scientists. They can be great physicians. They can be great artists. And they discover all sorts of wonderful things, and it doesn't lead them to the source. It doesn't lead them to the origin of the mystery. Who created the mystery, and why is there a mystery? And there are all sorts of reasons for that. And perhaps the most important reason is that as long as you don't get to God in your discovery, you can carry on having a good time. There's no moral obligation to do anything. It doesn't change your life. It doesn't impose any changes on your lifestyle. If you get to God in your discovery process, then you've got to draw some conclusions that might not always be so comfortable. They're conclusions that might require lifestyle modification. And so there's an enormous resistance on the part of people to allow their discovery process to lead to God, because that links life to God. People don't mind God as long as he stays in shul and in churches, and as long as he keeps out of their life, they don't mind him. But once you start allowing the process of discovery to lead you to God, then God starts impacting on your life, and that's quite serious stuff. And that's what the Torah is about. The Torah is leading us down the path of discovery of the linkage between Hashem and life. It's not just a study of God. That's the Kabbalistic things is a study of God. That's not the Torah. The Torah is the study of the linkage between God and the human being. How God impacts on our lives, how we impact on God, and so you just mentioned the word Kabbalah, and all sorts of funny things start happening in the background. And that's really what it is. Now, in the Torah, up until now, says the Medrash, we've been dealing with God's mystery. In this creation, which now is concluded, God includes all the mystery that we will uncover and discover throughout the rest of the existence of the human race. Whatever has to be discovered is all built into the world at this time. There is no further creation process. We don't run out of creation. There won't be a time where we'll finish the discovery process and God will have to give us a new world to start discovering. That's not going to happen. God has built in infinite mystery to allow us an infinite process of discovery. And that's that relation. The honor of God is to be mysterious. The honor of God is to be unreachable in a sense. To be out there, we're striving towards him, but we never quite get there. And the honor of the human being, the honor of the prince, the human nobility, is to continue in the process of hakodava, analyzing, thinking, questioning, searching, discovering. And it's very sad when that process of discovery stops. When one has a religious involvement that doesn't entail questioning, discovery. In people's desire for black and white certainty and clarity, they sometimes veer away from the hazardous process of exploration. Because exploration leads to discovery. The problem with exploration is you never know where you're going to land up. Never quite sure. That's the excitement. Some people find that exciting and challenging, and some people find it threatening. There's a very narrow line between being challenged and being threatened. And it really depends on the individual. And I've often said in the last few weeks, I've been emphasizing that Judaism is not a religion for people who feel threatened. And when people who feel threatened become religious, they become religious in a very structured, dogmatic sort of way. And they lose that whole idea of Kvod Malachim Chakor Dover. The honor of the nobleman, the human nobility rests in chakur, in questioning, in analyzing, in discovering. That's where the nobility is, not in mystery. And we do it the other way around. If I were to have advertised the subject of tonight's shir as being a mystical approach to creation, the chances are we would have had twice as many people here, because people love mystery. And if I would have given the shir in broken English, we would have had even more people here. And probably had I given the shir in some foreign language, you know my story with the Reverend Moon and Billy Graham. It's a very important story, and it happened a long time ago, about 15 years ago, when I was in California talking to a young fellow who was a Jew, who used to be a religious Jew. He'd become a Moonie. Remember the Moonies? He tried to come to South Africa recently. I think they didn't let him in, Reverend Moon. The Reverend Moon was busy in America, and he was converting people. And this young fellow had become a Moonie, and I couldn't figure it out. So I said, why have you become a Moonie? He says, well, you must just hear the man. You can't, it's irresistible. It is so beautiful, and it is so holy, and it is on he goes. I said, when did you hear him? I said, I would love to hear him. he said, no, he was just in California last week, and I heard him, and there must have been a million people in the stadium listening to him. I said, that's incredible, all young people. He said, mostly young people. I said, what language did he speak in? He said, in Korean. I said, was it translated? He said, it didn't have to be translated. The sanctity just grew. You didn't have to translate it. So I thought, okay, Meshuggah and a million other Meshuggahs. But from California, I flew to Korea, as it happens, just by chance. That's where I was going. And in the taxi on the way from the airport, Hashem works in strange ways. The taxi driver could hardly speak English, but he engaged in conversation with me, and we were going through a big square, and there were still sort of makeshift seats and sort of places there for lots and lots of people to sit. So I said, how many people can this place hold? He says, a million. I said, have a million people ever gathered here? I've never seen a million people together. He says, once, last week. I said, I don't believe it. A million people were here last week. He said, absolutely. I said, what happened? What was happening here? He said, Billy Graham was here. I said, a million Koreans came to hear Billy Graham. He said, a million Koreans. I said, what language did Billy Graham speak in? He said, English. I said, there was a translated. You know what he answered? You didn't have to translate it. So there the Koreans flocked to hear Billy Graham, and the Americans flocked to hear Reverend Moon. Why? Because it's mysterious. People love things. When it comes to religion, they don't want to understand it. They don't want it to be rational. They don't want it to be reasonable. They like it to be absurd. And the more absurd you make it, the more they feel religious. The more they feel that they're doing it right, that they're doing it correctly. It's so clear, and it's so worrying, and it's so disturbing. If one wants a big religious following, you've got to tell people to do absurd things, to wear absurd things, and to stop doing nice things, to stop eating all the things they like because they're treif, to stop doing all the things they like because it's no good, to stop wearing all the clothes they like because it's not sneers. The more you tell them of that, the more they love it. They lap it up. They love it. They feel so holy. It's like Reverend Moon's drosha and Billy Graham's drosha. The less you understand of it, the more absurd it is, the more holy it feels. So what are we doing? We're taking the process of getting to know God and we're making it mysterious. And it's not supposed to be mysterious. Gemara is logical. Chumash is logical. They're words. They have meanings. They have interpretations. The interpretations have to make sense. They have to be integrated into a normal life. Judaism is an incredibly rational religion. And we're making it irrational because we love the absurd. And that's not how it's supposed to be. Hashem is mysterious because we can't get to the bottom of him. But our analysis process, our process of trying to get to know him, has to be one of chakor dovo, has to be one of analysis, of understanding, and of questioning. And that starts here, because here man is introduced. Up until here, there's no man. If there's no man, there's not much we can really understand about this first part of the Torah. We learn through it, and we try to gain certain dimensions of appreciation from it. But if you're not watching man respond, it's very difficult for us human beings to interpret events, to understand what's happening. These big, huge things are taking place. Can't really understand them. All these beautiful pictures that the Hubble telescope is sending back to us. They're beautiful. They're magnificent. You can't really understand them. What's going on? When these things happened? How they happened? Why they happened? Very difficult to understand because we're not studying man's reaction to them. They all took place before there were people. And up until this point, it's all part of the mystery of the universe. Now we're starting with a human being. Once the human being is introduced into the picture, rationality, questioning is introduced into the picture, and we're entitled to start the questioning process. And it's interesting that being the case, God says he looked at everything he did, v'hinei tov ma'od, and it was exceptionally good. So the one understanding of that is because man is in the picture. For the first time, man is in the picture. We'll come back to that understanding in a little while, but firstly, let's look at some of the Midrashim on what does it mean when God says it was very good, it was really very, very good. In Rabbi Meir's Chumash, there was a note in the margin here. Obviously, Rabbi Meir used to scribble in his margins. And what did he write here? On Tov Ma'od, he says, and it was very good, he wrote Tov Mois instead of Tov Ma'od. Tov Mois means death is good. Now, it doesn't mean that he was a pessimistic sort of death-loving person, Rabbi Meir, not that at all. What does it mean? And they go on, and several other people share that view, that what God created on the sixth day was death. And he considered that as a very important creation. And the Midrash says one of the reasons that he created death is because he foresaw, Ro'uyo yo Adam arishun sheloi litim ta'amiso. Really, Adam should not have died. V'lamo niknaso b'miso. Why was he given death? Why was he punished with death? Now, if I asked you the question, normally you would say, because you know the story afterwards, he ate from the tree that he shouldn't have, and God warned him and so on, but that's not what the Medrash says. The reason he got death was, Elat Sofa HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shenebuchadnezzar V'chiru Melech Tzur Asidim Lasis Atzman Elohus. God foresaw that Nebuchadnezzar and Hiram and others were going to set themselves up as gods. Ulefichoch Niknesol Boimiso. And so God institutes death so that no human being will ever be able to set himself up as a god. And the proof that the Medrash brings is from a verse in Yechezkel where it says, "Be'eden Gan Elokim Hoyiso." You were in the Garden of God, in Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden. V'chi beGan Eden Hoyo Chiram? Was Chiram ever in the Garden of Eden? Elo Amar Loi. What he's saying to him is, "Atohu shegoramto loisoy shebe'eden sheyomus." It's you, Chiram, and you, Nebuchadnezzar, that caused death to he who was in Gan Eden, to Adam. So we see this is very important for us when we come to interpreting the whole scene with the. With the sin and with the snake and all that, which is some exciting stuff on that. But what's going to be important for us there to realize is that it had already been decided that Adam was going to die. So let's not blame poor Adam completely. At this time already, on the sixth day, it was already decided God wanted Adam to die because he realized that death had to be part of life. That if death wasn't part of life, life would have no boundaries, and man's self-image and man's ego would have no boundaries either. That in order to place boundaries on man's ego, death was necessary. And God looks at death and says, Tov Moed, everything I created is good, but death is Tov Moed. That just completes the picture. That makes it complete. Now, there's another reason that death is important. And that is, what is it about the creation of man, the introduction of man, that makes the creation so complete? Why would the creation not have been complete without the introduction of man? It's interesting that in all the discussion, in all the description up until now, there's no mention of anything religious. It's actually quite fascinating. This is the Torah. This is the textbook of religion. And the opening chapter doesn't mention anything religious, not once. It mentions God, because he's the character in the story, obviously. He's the guy writing the story, so God is there. But it says nothing about religion. It says nothing about Kedusha, nothing about sanctity, nothing about the Torah. Nothing. It doesn't exist. The 6 days of creation, there's no mention. Because the Torah deals with values, and for values you need a human being. Values means prioritizing, means what's more important than what. What are you prepared to pay for, and how much are you willing to pay for it? If there's no human being, there's no sense of value. Animals don't have values. And so values, kedusha, sanctity, which is a value, could not be introduced until man was introduced. And furthermore, even with man being introduced, if there was no death, there would probably also not be able to be values, because time would have no value. If time has no value, then virtually nothing has any value, because sooner or later you can get around to everything. There would be no sense of urgency, there would be no sense of limited resources. Sooner or later there would be no limitation if a person couldn't risk his life, if life didn't have a value, if human life didn't have a value because it was eternal, then it would be impossible for man to really value anything else. Death is necessary to place a limit on life. The limit on life gives value to time. Value to time makes a human being have to make choices. And the necessity to make choices expresses the human being's value system. When a person has to make a decision whether to go to shul or to watch Bafana Bafana, that's a value system. He can't do both. Can't do both, he's got to make a choice. If time was unlimited, it wouldn't be necessary for a human being ever to make a choice, and there wouldn't be a value system. So Hashem looks at death and says, that's the key to the success of the creation. And it goes on and says, death is also not such a bad thing for people in another way, says the Medrash, because God made death for the following reason. Mipnei mo nigzoro miso al harashoyim. Why do wicked people have to die? Because as long as wicked people are alive, they irritate God. So for God it's quite a relief when they die. But what about tzaddikim then? Why do righteous people have to die? Says the Medrash, as long as tzaddikim are alive, they're also struggling. They're irritating themselves. It's a struggle. Life is a struggle. They're struggling with all their different complexities, with all their different tensions within them. The Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov, as we've discussed, this human being, being the only being who spans the full spectrum from ultimate sanctity to ultimate materialism and everything in between of that, the human being lives under enormous tension, and death is a relief. We don't look at death as a terrible thing for the person. If he's lived a righteous life, death is a relief. Finally, the struggle is over. So the Medrash says, so why not give death to the Rishoyim and not death to the Tzadikim? The Medrash says, Shelo yu harishoyim oisim teshuvo shel ramayus. Because if the consequence of righteousness was so obvious, people would be more fake than they are. People are sometimes fake. Why? Because they want to achieve results which they're not really prepared to work for. So they create the impression that they're working for it, but they're not really doing it. Imagine if you could earn eternity by being righteous. There would be a lot of fake righteousness around. And we wouldn't be able to distinguish. It's bad enough now. We look at people and we say, why is so-and-so having a difficult time and why is so-and-so having a good time? We don't know who's righteous and who isn't righteous, and it causes all sorts of questions with us. Imagine then, people would realize that if you're good, you have eternity. So people would act good in public anyway. We would look at them and say, Shat Tzadikim, and then they would die, because God would know they're a Shoim, and we would start wondering what kind of system of justice God has got. And the whole world would be built on fake. So the only way it could function is that there needs to be death for everybody. That you can't bribe God, you can't carry favor with God. Death is going to be there. Sooner or later we all get it, and that we know absolutely, and it has its pros and its cons, but generally God is satisfied with it. It brings a sense of balance to the world, a sense of value to the world. The Midrash goes on to say, Hinei tov mo'ed ze yetzer tov, Hinei tov mo'ed ze yetzer hara. There's another extra letter here. The Torah learns from every extra word or letter. The extra vav, Vayara lukim is kol asher asa. It could have said, Hinei tov mo'ed was very good. Vehinei tov mo'ed means, and it was very good. That means God was looking at two things simultaneously, and they were both very good. And what he was looking at, says the Medrash, is the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. Normally translated as the good inclination and the evil inclination, which is a poor translation. Firstly, a Yetzer is much more powerful than an inclination. A Yetzer is a drive, it's a passion. And secondly, let's take it there for a minute. It says the Medrash, V'chi Yetzer Hara Tov Ma'od? That's rather peculiar. God's looking at the world, and he's just created man, and he's created man with all these tensions, and part of the tension is the tension between the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. The Yetzer HaTov drives him to be holy and to learn Torah and to keep mitzvahs and to be kind to people. That's all the Yetzer HaTov. But the Yetzer Hara drives him to be jealous and to be angry and to be mean and to be destructive and to deny God. That's the Yetzer Hara. And God says he looked at both, Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov. He knew Tov Mo'ed, it was very good. Says the Medrash, yes, because Ilule Yetzer Hara, very important Medrash, classical. Were it not for the Yetzer Hara, Loi Bono Adam Bayis, nobody would build anything. Loi Noso Isho, nobody would get married. Velo Helid, and if they did get married, they wouldn't have children. Velo Noso Venoso, and nobody would deal, there would be no business, people wouldn't deal with one another. That means that all of those things are functions of the Yetzer Hara. Part of the function, this Yetzer Hara, which we're taught to despise and to try and kill and get rid of the Yetzer Hara. What is that Yetzer Hara? Yetzer Hara is the drive for productivity. Yetzer Hara is the drive to be better than the next guy. The competitive drive is Yetzer Hara. The sexual drive is Yetzer Hara. The drive for eternity, to have children and family, is Yetzer Hara. To build structures, to build buildings, to build homes, Yetzer Hara. All of that is the Yetzer Hara. So we have to get very clear right at the beginning that there is no desire to get rid of this Yetzer Hara. And it's interesting that in the Torah there's no special word for Yetzer Hara. There's no different word for Yetzer Hara as there is in other languages. We don't have devils and angels and things like that. It's Yetzer, it's one Yetzer. And Yetzer means create. Yetzer is the creative drive. And there's a Yetzer Hara and there's a Yetzer HaTov. There's a creative drive which is directed positively, and there's a creative drive which is directed negatively. When the person is positively creative, then he's building houses, he's building families, he's doing business, that's how he's using it. When he's negatively creative, or when his creative drive is not being fulfilled, then he destroys, then he becomes an incredibly destructive being. But if the human being loses that drive, loses that passion, what happens to him? He becomes a non-entity, he becomes completely ineffectual. And I talked in Shul in Shabbos 2 weeks ago about the tendency today of loss of personality as people become religious. Because one of the things they think as they become religious is they've got to get rid of this Yetzer Hara business. And in the process of getting rid of the Yetzer Hara, they pretend, they don't really get rid of the Yetzer Hara, you can't get rid of it. They pretend they're getting rid of it because they think that makes them look very righteous. So they walk around and act as if they don't have a Yetzer Hara. And the result of that, there are all sorts of funny results of that. It says the Medrash, life stops. No Yetzer Hara, no life. There's no drive, there's no ambition, there's nothing without the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara has to be nurtured and directed correctly. So God's looking at a lot of things that we traditionally look at as the essence of bad. If I were to say to you, what are the real bad things in the world? What would you love to rid the world of? One would be death. Another one, most people would say the Yetzer Hara. Goodness, I could just get rid of the Yetzer Hara. I could focus on the right things. And God looks at those same things that we regard as so evil. And God says they're wonderful. They're the best thing in the world. I need them in the world. And then we start realizing how far off our perceptions and understandings are from God's. What we define as good and evil is not what the Ribbono Shel Olam defines as good and evil. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam wants contrast. There can only be beauty if there is ugliness. There can only be light if there is darkness. There can only be life if there is death. There can only be good if there is bad. There has to be contrast. It's contrast that creates richness. And the tendency in our religious lives today is to deny contrast, to create a sort of a dull, grey, amorphous mass and call it religion. And that's not what it's meant to be. That's not life. Life is contrast. Life is differences. Life is showing different, highlighting differences and measuring those differences and responding to those differences. That's life. And the contrast of the complete difference, firstly of what man is, including the angelic on the one hand, and including the very ordinary, the human on the other hand, bringing all of that together into one being, that's man. Contrast. Man, every human being is full of contrast. And then we look at what God found, Tov Mo'od, what He found so exceptionally good was the contrast of life and death, of Yetzirah Tov and Yetzer Hara. These opposite forces God looks at and He says, but this is what makes life real. This is what makes life exciting. This is what enables people to discover. This is what enables people to live. This is the essence of it all. Don't let them destroy it. Now the Midrash says it's talking about suffering. And the Medrash says, is suffering good? Surely that's not good. And the Medrash says, yes, because that way too, it's the contrast. You can't have comfort if you don't have suffering. You can't have pleasure if you don't have discomfort. There needs to be the contrast in order to appreciate it. There needs to be times of pain in order to appreciate times of joy. One needs to be able to see. One doesn't have to have it oneself. If one has the capacity to empathize with people, then from other people's pain and suffering, one can establish the contrast, provided you can share that pain. To share somebody else's pain enables you to feel your well-being, your sense of well-being. Terribly important. And there needs to be that contrast. There needs to be the suffering together with the pleasure. Omer Rabbi Zeira says, Hinei tov mo'od ze gan eden, Hinei tov mo'od ze gehenem. God looks at two things, Gan Eden and Gehenim. And He says they're both beautiful, they're both good, very good. Stachi Gehenim Tov Mo'ed, is Gehenim so good? Gehenim is the Jewish equivalent of hell, but it doesn't mean the same. And the Gemara says, Mashal le'melech shehayolei pardes v'ichnis l'seicho pa'alim. It's like a king who has an orchard and he brings workers into the orchard. Uvono Oitzer al Pischoy, next to the entrance of the orchard, he builds a treasury. Omar kol mishu miskasher bimleches apardes ikones lo yitzoroi. Whoever does well in the work can go into the treasury afterwards and help himself. Vachol mishu einu miskasher bimleches apardes al yikones lo yitzoroi. And anybody who doesn't do well at work can't go into the treasury. So there has to be a consequence. You can't just say, go into the paradise, and when you're finished, everybody can go into the treasury. No, he says, those who've done well will go into the treasury. Those who haven't done well won't go. That establishes value in the work. Otherwise, where's the value? Kach mishu misagil b'mitzvi sumasim tovim harei gan eden. So a person who applies himself to doing good deeds and fine things, he has gan eden. V'chol mishu misagil b'mitzvi sumasim tovim harei gehenem. And if he doesn't develop himself using mitzvahs and fine deeds, then he has Gehenim. Now look at the Medrash comparing the two stories, Gehenim and Gan Eden on the one hand, to the king on the other hand, where you go in and you work in the business, you work in the orchard, And if you make it, you go into the treasury. What did it say? If you don't make it, you don't go into the treasury. So what is Gehenna? We have a definition of Gehenna here, of Jewish hell. Gehenna is not being allowed into Gan Eden. That's all. There's nothing more terrible than that, because there is nothing more terrible than that. You don't need all sorts of other suffering, burning fires and all sorts of terrible things. There's nothing worse than to come out of a lifetime, to see Gan Eden, and to be told, sorry, you didn't make it. Had you done one more mitzvah, you could have gotten in. Just one. Remember that time when you had to make a decision to do A or to B, do B, and you decided B. Had you just done A instead of B, the balance would have been tipped, and you could have gone inside. Sorry, it's going to be a while before we can let you into there. You need some more work on yourself. You can't go in. That's how it is. And anybody who's been in that kind of situation in this world understands the devastation of that kind of feeling. When there's something very important that you've been working for, and you just haven't made it, you just haven't passed an exam, or you needed to get an A and you just missed an A, or you needed to catch a plane and you just missed the plane. It's a terrible, terrible feeling of disappointment and wastage. And if only I wouldn't have done such a silly thing, I could have so easily done it. When you get there, you realize how easy it was, how easy it would have been to get there. That's Gehenna. It's nothing more complicated than that and more mystical than that. It's quite clear from the Medrash, Gehenna is just not being in Gan Eden. Gan Eden is a place of fulfillment, and Gehenna is not being allowed into that place of fulfillment. Terribly frustrating. And God says it has to be there, and it's very good, because if everybody went to the Garden of Eden, then there would be no consequence. If there's no consequence, there's no value. If there's no value, what is it all about? Once we introduce man in with free choice, with decision-making ability, there has to be a consequence for his decisions. He has to be able to take responsibility for that and create his own Olam Habo, create his own world to come. That when he does go to the Garden of Eden, it's because of what he did himself. He can go there in the full joy. I worked for it. I deserved it. It's mine. And the only way that can be is if the alternative is if you didn't make it, you don't get in. And therefore it's tov moed, it's very good. So all these things that we think are so terrible, God looks at and says it's really important for the world to have it. That being the case, and now the world is set with man there, with good and evil, with the ability to choose good and evil, with death and life, with consequences of those choices, the Garden of Eden and Gehenna. Now the story of life is ready to begin. And what's the first thing that happens? Interesting, this is the point where creation ends, so to say. This is the point where the Medrash says the mystery is over. Now starts real life. What is the first thing that happens? What is the first element of life? Strange thing, you would think man's ready, created, he's an adult, he's ready to go out. One would think the first thing is he would go out, he would start exploring, he would start doing things, creating things, building things. First thing, Shabbos. That's the first thing that hits man when he comes out, when he's born. And we're told by Chulu HaShemayim V'Ho'oretz, the Chol Tzva'om, the heavens and the earth and all that went with them were completed. Vayechal Elohim b'yom ha-shvi'i melachto asher aso, and Hashem finished on the seventh day the work which he had done. Vayishbos b'yom ha-shvi'i mikol melachto asher aso, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. Vayevorech Elohim es yom ha-shvi'i, and Hashem blessed the seventh day. Vayekadesh aso, and he sanctified it. First time that we see the word. The first time that sanctity, that kedusha, that godliness is introduced into the story on Shabbos. Why? Because on that day God rested from all the work that he had done. And as I said, Shabbos is going to take us part of this week and probably the whole of next week, because all I'm going to do this week is shift some thinking and some paradigms. What is Shabbos? It says God rested on the seventh day. It also says God finished his work on the seventh day, which is a bit contradictory. What did he create on the seventh day? What was it? I'm going to take you through a bit of thinking. It's really difficult, subtle, and it's deep. Of Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, who's probably one of the deepest modern Torah thinkers. And he explains a piece of Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon says that it says we say it in the davening every day. Hamechadesh v'tuva b'chol yom tomid ma'aseh bereishis. God renews every day continuously the act of creation. And ask the Vilna Gaon, what about Shabbos? If he does it on Shabbos as well, why does it say he stopped creating on Shabbos? And if he doesn't do it on Shabbos, then our statement is inaccurate. It's not every day continuously. And he says very, very briefly, and it's difficult to understand what he means, that the creation of Shabbos was prepared from the day before. So God did just what we do. We put our cholim tin on Erev Shabbos on Friday afternoon, and it cooks all over right through Shabbos. So there is a creative process taking place, but we're not actively involved in it. So God programmed the creative process, but he did so on Friday, and the creative process continues. That's really all the Vilna Gaon says. Let me take you through a bit of Huttner's thinking. There are a lot of laws on Shabbos that look terribly dry and technical and minute, and yet they reveal such fundamental principles. And this is one example of them. There's a Mishnah. The Mishnah says the following. If you carry an object out, let's say you carry a matchbox into a Rishus HaRabim, you carry it over the M1 or Lubavitch Avenue or one of these big streets, that's an Issur D'oraisa, that's a serious thing. If you carry food, there's a certain measure of food which is as serious. All carrying is not allowed, but there are different levels of seriousness. So the food has to be able to fulfill some kind of purpose. If you're carrying too little food to fulfill any valuable purpose, then that action of carrying is virtually meaningless. Now what happens, says the Mishnah, if you carry a bit of food in a matchbox? It's a little small piece of food in the matchbox, and you carry it across the road. So the food is not called carrying because it's too small. But the matchbox, you're carrying a matchbox? Says the Mishnah, it's still not called carrying. Because the matchbox is tofel, it's subordinate to the food. If you're carrying an empty matchbox, then you want the matchbox. If the matchbox is merely the container of the food, and the food is irrelevant, then the matchbox becomes irrelevant as well. Now, there are lots of all sorts of interesting implications to that law, but Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner says, the principle of Iker v'tofel, that means in the laws of Shabbos, is embedded a principle where you have to decide. When deciding on the validity of an action, you've got to look at the principle of Iker and Tofel, which is subordinate to which. So there's a value judgment. You're saying, is the matchbox important in its own right, or is the matchbox important simply in its role as serving the food? And the food is irrelevant, therefore the matchbox becomes irrelevant. So you can take in that halakha and that law, you can take a matchbox, which is a relevant object, and if you carry it across the road, it's an isur misa, it's a capital offense, it's very serious. And by placing food in it, you're changing the value of the matchbox to the point that the carrying of the matchbox becomes irrelevant. So what these laws of Shabbos are teaching us is that objects, the value of objects, has to be measured in terms of their value, of what their purpose is. Not just of what they are in terms of financial value. It doesn't matter even if it's not a matchbox, even if it's a matchbox made of gold, will still be the same rule. If the matchbox is being used to contain the food, then you've got to look at the food to determine the value of the matchbox in terms of spiritual value. So value is determined by which is subordinate and which is superior. What is serving what? You've got to look at a hierarchy in order to understand the value of a particular object. What's that all going to do with Shabbos? He says the following. What is Shabbos? What you say on Shabbos is, you're declaring Shabbos is the most important day of the week, and that all your efforts for the week are there to give you a Shabbos. Sometimes people do that with holidays. People come to the end of the year and they take a beautiful holiday and they say that the whole year was worth it. I've worked the whole year to be able to afford this holiday. Or they buy themselves something that they've worked hard for a couple of years, they've saved up money, they buy a home or they buy a car, and they say, this makes me feel good, it's all been worthwhile. What are you really saying? That the purpose of the working was in order to enable me to have this. Shabbos is not a day where you cut yourself off and say, oh yeah, now for the whole day, 25 hours, I can't do anything, what a miserable day. Shabbos has to be the kind of day where you say the whole week has been worth it to support this, to support Shabbos. Because when Shabbos comes along, you start doing things that are against the dynamic of the whole week. Now, let me give you an example of that in God's case. Do you remember we had in the Chumash a week or two ago that there were certain creatures God was busy creating when Shabbos came in? You remember that? And He stopped. Why did He stop? And when He stopped, these things were incomplete and they became negative forces in the world. Those were the ghosts, the Shadim. A shade is a ghost, there's a concept of a ghost, that's a spirit without a body. God created the spirit, and He didn't get round to creating the body. It was Shabbos, He had to stop. So He left them without bodies, and they became very destructive forces in the world. And the question is, why did God not finish it off? How long does it take God to create? It takes Him a flash of a second. He knew Shabbos was coming, so why didn't He just work a little faster and finish the job off? And we explained, because God wanted to teach us that when Shabbos comes, even if you're in the middle of something major, and by not completing it, you're going to blow it completely. You blow it. Because there's nothing more important than Shabbos. Everything is subservient to Shabbos. That's what Shabbos is meant to do. It comes in at a certain time, and the normal dynamic stops. The normal dynamic is that if you can earn a certain amount by working 6 days a week, you should be able to earn at least one-sixth more by working 7 days a week. That's the normal thing. But we don't. We stop the seventh day. If you're in the middle of something, you should finish it off. What's the big deal? We don't finish it off. We stop. There are things that we do on Shabbos which are counter to normal life. And what are we saying by that? We're saying that that's the absolute. That Shabbos is the greatest day, the most special day. It's the day Jews have given their lives for Shabbos. No Jew has ever given his life for Sunday, or for Monday, or for Tuesday, or for Wednesday, or for Thursday, or for Friday. But thousands upon thousands of Jews have given their lives for Shabbos. Shabbos is a day that has kept us as a Jewish people. It's a day that enables us to withdraw. We'll have a lot more to say about Shabbos when we get into the whole sin of Odom Harishon. Shabbos is the day that allows us to withdraw in order to take an objective look at the world. In order to be able to analyze that Chakor Dover, to start researching, to use our minds rather than become involved in the hows of life, to start looking at the whys of life. Instead of becoming totally involved in production, start becoming involved in thinking, in intellect, in philosophy, in reasoning, in the social side of life, in family. That's Shabbos. All of those things take place on Shabbos. And it's peculiar how you have to stop doing the productive things in order to become productive in the spiritual things. It doesn't work. The two of them don't work together. There's got to be a stoppage on the one hand in order to become active in the other area. And by accepting Shabbos and stopping that normal dynamic, we are creating a hierarchy. And we are saying our natural lives come second. Our natural life is there to support our sanctity. It's there to support our Kedusha. Our 6 days are there to support our seventh day. And the seventh day has the power to enrich the next 6 days as well. But the essence of it is what we're able to absorb on Shabbos. Now, it's very difficult speaking like this to you when we live in a society where Shabbos is very difficult to experience. Because The way life operates here, we just don't. Shabbos is a funny sort of day here. Very seldom do people really get from a Shabbos what they're supposed to get from a Shabbos. It's supposed to be a day of enormous joy, of enormous family unity, of beautiful social interaction, of in-depth learning, of lovely learning, where everybody grows together and develops and is sharing ideas. It's supposed to be an incredibly rich day that provides the spiritual and intellectual impetus for the rest of the week. It's interesting. You remember the Medrash we did last week about the four qualities that the human being has that are godly and the four qualities that he has that are animal. So he eats, he sleeps, he reproduces, he excretes like animals, and he is upright, he sees, he speaks, and he thinks like angels. It's interesting, on the uprightness story, after last week's shiur, Joel Shapiro brought me an article written by a non-Jewish psychologist that talks about the uprightness of human posture as the essence of humanity. I'm just busy with it. When I'm finished with it, we'll discuss it in greater detail. But he shows how virtually everything that differentiates a human being from an animal results from his being upright. If he weren't upright, he would not be able to speak. And he says that the time of speaking of a baby and the time of standing is about the same time. It's only when he can detach himself from the world and he can start standing and walking as an upright being that he can start communicating properly. And we wouldn't be able to manufacture things, and we wouldn't be able to think properly. There are all sorts of things that are all the human faculties. He shows can only be achieved because we're upright. And he shows how our uprightness is totally different from the apes. The ape is not upright. The structure of his bones are not upright. He's a completely different being, created in a completely different way. But the human being is designed for uprightness. And from an evolutionary point of view, that's absurd. Because from an evolutionary point, the evolutionists claim that we would be getting more and more sophisticated. That we're getting at survival of the fittest. We're developing better and stronger structures. But uprightness is not a strong structure from a physical point of view. All the back problems are because we're upright. All the spinal problems are because we're upright. Women in pregnancy suffer a lot because they're upright. It's not a natural thing to be. On the contrary, this writer shows how the moment you fall asleep, what happens to you? You fall over. You can't sleep standing upright. A horse can stand on his four legs, can sleep on his... The time switch can turn on your lights, no problem. All the Shabbos is a determination that nature is there to serve me and to serve my spiritual needs, not the other way around. Nature is there to support Shabbos. Shabbos is not there to support nature. And so God, by creating on Friday, and that's what the Vilna Gaon means, says Rabbi Tzachutna, on Friday God creates man with a human intellect. Because only the human intellect can make a value choice. The value choice is Shabbos. Shabbos means this comes first. And nature comes second. That value choice gives meaning to everything else and allows creation to continue right through Shabbos. What's important is also that Shabbos introduces sanctity into the world, because before that there was no Shabbos. There was no sanctity. The Orach Chaim has an interesting analysis, a Kabbalistic one, where he says, when we say Ki Sheshes Yomim Asa Hashem Es HaShamayim, it doesn't say God made the world in 6 days. It says God made the world Sheshes Yomim for 6 days. And he works out that God gave the creation the ability to be sustained for 6 days. That's all. And that took it up to Shabbos. Shabbos gives it the ability to be sustained for another 6 days. In other words, each time we keep a Shabbos, each time we make that value choice, each time we subject nature to the supportive role, to support sanctity, the world can continue for another 6 days. And that's why we say that anybody who keeps Shabbos becomes a partner in Hashem in the act of creation. Because creation occurs every week anew. And the quality of the creation of next week depends on the quality of Shabbos this week. It's Shabbos that actually gives the cohesive power to the world. It's Shabbos that gives one focused sense of purpose to the world. It's Shabbos that makes everything else in the world meaningful and worthwhile. Take Shabbos away and there is no value. Take Shabbos away, there is no choice. Take Shabbos away, there is no meaning. Nature and science just becomes an end in itself, and it's there to support nothing at all. That really is the role of Shabbos, and that's the meaning of Shabbos. We'll take Shabbos further next week and lead from there into the Garden of Eden. But what's important here is, and we'll see, we'll be looking at Shabbos will be in time what Garden of Eden is in place. Garden of Eden is a place that has that spiritual perfection, and Shabbos is a place in time that has the capacity to develop that spiritual perfection. But what's important this evening is to shift our mindsets away from Shabbos being a restrictive day to Shabbos being a liberating day. It's true that in order to liberate certain parts of ourselves, we have to exclude certain other parts. If we allow ourselves to remain engrossed in the process of production, there's no way that we could become engrossed in the process of sanctity. it's actually necessary to withdraw from one to become engrossed in the other. We can become engrossed in Shabbos, then we can get out of it. But the idea of Shabbos is it should be a day of enormous expansiveness, enormous liberation, enormous freedom. It's not a day. If one feels restricted on Shabbos, we're doing it wrong. That's the important thing to know. And one should check out what one's doing wrong. Because if one feels restricted on Shabbos, that's not Shabbos. It needs to be exactly the opposite. The feeling of restriction is during the 6 days of the week, where there are limitations, where one is bound strictly by the limits of nature. Comes Shabbos, one moves away from that and one does the unnatural, one does the supernatural, and dedicates oneself, no matter what the cost, to that which is spiritual and that which is worthwhile. The guarantee God does give us is Vayavorech Elokim es Yom HaShvi'i. God gives a blessing to Shabbos that allows the Jew to be able to keep the Shabbos without sacrificing his material well-being. But if one keeps the Shabbos properly, God has given Shabbos the capacity to ensure that the quality of the rest of the week is such that we're able to make it up. And that, of course, is expressed in the idea of the mon. You'll remember that on Friday a double portion of mon was delivered so that there would be nothing lacking by the fact that the Jew withdraws himself on Shabbos. So provided he's willing to go through the process and to make that value judgment, there isn't actually a material cost. But he needs to be willing to take the material cost before he can benefit from the material blessing. But we'll have more of that next weekend.